past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, featuring unique shopping and the historic Jack's Cafe, featuring an eclectic menu, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, modernized for a new age. Visit jackanddrea.com for more information. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today's morning show interview was newly recorded last week. We're going to be exploring today a story that I suspect none of you know anything about. Certainly, I knew nothing about this story until I took in hand Neil Bascom's fascinating new book called Faster, How a Jewish Driver, an American Heiress, and a Legendary Car Beat Hitler's Best. This is a story that in some ways runs parallel to the very well-known story of Jesse Owens and his triumph at the 1936 Berlin Olympic Games, except that this involves the sphere of auto racing. And it's a story that for a number of different reasons has been almost completely forgotten, and forgotten no longer thanks to best-selling author Neil Bascom. He is responsible for a number of fascinating books, including The Winter Fortress, The Escape Artists, and I want to make mention of his book, The Perfect Mile. I had the pleasure of interviewing Mr. Bascom about this book, which explored the quest to run the 4-minute mile. Of course, a quest that was ultimately won by the great Roger Bannister. And his book was a thorough and fascinating chronicle of that effort and of the efforts of three elite runners in particular to seize that audacious goal of running the first 4-minute mile. And he's done it again with another fascinating book published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, again titled Faster, How a Jewish Driver, an American Heiress, and a Legendary Car Beat Hitler's Best. Neil Bascom, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. That was a lovely introduction.
I am excited to talk with you about this. Before we explore the story, I wonder if we could talk about the level to which this story is forgotten. First of all, to what extent is this, or was this, before you wrote your book, a largely forgotten story? And to what extent it was forgotten, why? Why was this important story so very obscure?
Well, I think it's largely, I mean, yes, it has been largely forgotten. There's very few slivers of this story that you find in motorsport histories, but in sort of contemporaneous accounts of what was going on at the period. I mean, this was absolutely huge news, and so to see that it subsequently sort of disappeared was something that I wanted to correct. And probably most importantly, the story of the heroine, Lucy Schell, who, you know, no one knows the name of her name, but she was the first woman to own and run her own Grand Prix team. She was one of the best Monte Carlo rally drivers, American Monte Carlo drivers in the world, and yet nobody knows who she was. And so in some ways, she's kind of like a hidden figures-like individual, and I'm proud and faster to sort of restore her place. And I guess the last thing I would say about this is, you know, this story about a Jewish driver and Lucy Schell overcoming the Nazi silver arrows was something that Hitler very much wanted to sort of squash the story of that. And so after the invasion of France, he made every effort to eliminate any record of the great race that René ran to beat the silver arrows, and even sought to destroy the cars that were involved in that competition.
Hmm. So it's no accident that this story is as obscure as it is, because that is something that Adolf Hitler himself really wanted. In fact, that's one of the most fascinating things about this story, is how intensely interested Adolf Hitler was in this whole matter of auto racing, and of his ferocious determination for Germany to be the best in this arena.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think it's probably one of the foremost reasons I ended up writing the book, because as much as I sort of love the story of Jesse Owens and the Olympics and the symbolism of all that, you know, this story about motorsport was not only sort of symbolic. I mean, Hitler wanted to dominate it for propaganda reasons, yes, but it was also sort of integral to his boosting of the economy. It was integral to his development against the Versailles Treaty, of developing a sort of motorized infantry. And so not only was it symbolic, but it was core to sort of the Third Reich's ambitions that we would end up seeing in the war. So, you know, a defeat or an attempt to stop the inevitable advance of the Silver Arrows was, you know, not just an entertaining motorsport story, but one that had real significance.
How much did you know about auto racing before you wrote this book?
I mean, embarrassingly or not, very little. And that's, you know, it's not unusual for, you know, the range of books that I've written over the course of my career, you know, everything from kids building robots to Russian mutinies to, you know, skyscraper wars in New York in the 20s. I sort of make it my mission over the course of the 2 to 3 years I spend on each of these books to kind of become a mini expert. So I knew nothing about auto racing before, but I probably could lick anybody in a trivia event about 1930s, sort of golden age of Grand Prix racing. I am now a mini expert on that.
I want to mention that your book includes two very interesting opening chapters, and I am so glad that they are both there. The first is an author's note, and then there is a prologue that follows it, and these two chapters are completely different from each other. The author's note, very much from the present day, and then the prologue, which interestingly enough basically follows the most important events of the book itself. It's an intriguing choice for you to open your book as you do, and I'm glad you do. I think both of these are very, very helpful for the reader. I wonder if you would just sketch both of them for our listeners.
Sure. It was something that I've never done before in an author's note, you know, just to start the book. But I thought it was kind of important to the story to see these cars in their present day. So in the author's note, I basically start out with readers sort of following me along the Pacific Coast Highway in a rented sort of boxy car that has no personality. And I'm driving up to Oxnard, California to drive and actually the Delahaye 145 race car, open top V12, built in 1936, 1937, a very different experience. And I wanted to sort of try to give readers the visceral experience of what it was like to drive in these race cars at the time, the sort of feel, the sound, the sort of, you know, you could, as I write, you could almost, you know, graze the ground with your fingertips. That's how sort of low they are to the pavement. And I thought it was, you know, no harnesses, no no helmets, no safety equipment of any type, you know, sort of bracing your knees against the sides of the car to stay within it. And so I thought it was important to, A, just show that and give users that sense, and also to sort of bring this story to the present, because of the four Delahaye race cars that were ever built, they have been restored to their glory, and it's kind of the significance of the story that it has not been lost to history, that it's kind of, as you said in this opening question, like restored to history. So that's what I do with the author's note. And then, you know, I sort of step a little bit back into history, starting with, you know, the German advance in the prologue, the German advance into France, and the hiding of all the various artworks, and also these Delahaye race cars, and sort of giving readers a teaser why this was important, seeing the Nazis go into the automobile clubs of France and seize the records, and they were never seen again. To, again, sort of give the, sort of the significance of this story. And, you know, I'm very glad you found that you liked it, because I felt like it was a bit of a risk to write it this way, because I'd never done before, but I'm hopefully glad I did.
We're speaking with Neil Bascom about his newest book called Faster, How a Jewish Driver, an American Heiress, and a Legendary Car Beat Hitler's Best. The book is about a very critically important race at a critically important time, as Europe was tilting towards the horrors of Nazism. But the story beyond that is also about this era in which auto racing was first taking off and was such a spectacularly popular and an important pastime. I'd really like to start there. And I really appreciate the fact that you include in the book so much rich and helpful context about sort of the nature of auto racing during this era. And I think most people would be surprised to know that there had been auto racing almost as long as there have been automobiles. I mean, even in the very, very earliest days. Maybe you could just sketch for us, at least in brief, kind of the evolution of the whole notion of car racing to the point that we reach when we get to the late 20s and into the 1930s?
Sure. I mean, I was kind of surprised at this as well, sort of reading about the not only the history of automobiles, but the history of motorsport, that the two are intertwined inseparably. That, you know, the cars were barely being advanced or built, and then soon after, people were racing them. And they were racing them largely to, you know, prove that they had the best car, just like we do today. And so, you know, you have by the, you know, 1890s, you have these city-to-city races. And then by the early 20th century, you're beginning to do circuit races, Grand Prix formula races, where you specify, you know, the car can be this weight, it can have this kind of engine, to sort of try to unify the kind of cars that are participating against each other. And you find that the cars, each and every year, get faster and faster, that the technology advances, that car racing kind of spurs that technology. It also spurs the public to want to own these cars. So again, they are inseparably intertwined. And the races become bigger and bigger, the cars get faster and faster, and so you have, by, you know, the 1930s, where my book begins, where these cars are going, you know, 80 to 90 miles an hour on average in some of these races, to over the course of the 30s going up to 250 miles an hour. So it's kind of a major leap in the speed and danger of what it was like to drive these cars. And so it was kind of this fascinating period where the safety, I mean, drivers were dying almost on a weekly basis, the safety versus the sort of advance in technology, which the Germans had a major impact with.
Right. Before we talk about you know, some of these different kinds of races and this era of racing, I also want to highlight what I found to be a really intriguing moment in the book. This is actually well into the book, during a chapter called A Very Good Story, in which we are, in which we are hearing about all that goes into the design of a given car, or when a successful car is, in a sense, redefined, refined, and becomes an even better car for racing. You write at one point, to design any car, let alone a Grand Prix competitor, to combat Mercedes and Auto Union demanded many things: the inspirational leaps of an artist and the deductive patience of a mechanic, as well as insights into metallurgy, electricity, physics, mathematics, aerodynamics, production, and of course, engineering. And in the next paragraph, you quote an automotive historian as saying, "A car is not a thing. It is an aggregation of things, a compound complex of numerous mutually supporting components that are infuriating because they are also mutually interfering. The man who can see how to eliminate these incompatibilities, how to make each component in such a way that it does its various tasks as well as can be, while detracting from the performance of all the other components as little as can be, can see how to design a car." I think most of us who just drive a car, I mean, without racing our cars, never stop to think about the intricate web of choices and decisions that are made in the design of a given automobile, let alone how true that must be when we are talking about this particular kind of arena. Tell us more about the almost unbelievable, intricate complexities that are part of designing cars, and especially when we're talking about designing cars to race.
I mean, there's so much that goes into, you know, as you quoted, into the design of these cars, and particularly when they're going at speeds of 200 miles an hour on a race course that's winding through the streets. You know, they not only need to hold to the road, they need to be durable, they need to be a certain weight, you know, the brakes need to be able to stop the car at various speeds. They have various different fuel requirements. I mean, designing and building them is just a Herculean effort. And it was very interesting to me to watch the company Delahaye produce the Grand Prix car that Rene drove and that Lucy Shell invested in, because this is a French automobile company that had, you know, over the from the 20s to the early 30s been known, I think the best quote is, for producing cars that, quote unquote, are best suited for a funeral procession. They were staid, they were not very fast, they, you know, the design was not great. They could ride forever, but not quickly. And so for this French automobile company to suddenly decide to save their company, that they'd need to build first sports cars and then go into the Grand Prix field, was just, utterly fascinating to watch the transition that they went through, that their engineer, Jean-Francois, because he was told, not only do you need to build a Grand Prix race car, but we need to develop it in a way such that we can use this car for the general person. So that was something that Mercedes and Auto Union weren't even thinking about. They were willing to spend whatever it took just for a Grand Prix race car. But Delahaye needed not only build a race car, but one that they could ship and build for the common individual. And that made it even more interesting. And so it probably, the development of the Delahaye 145 took roughly a year to design and build and work out all the kinks. And it was a constant process, an iterative process of fine-tuning, fixing, making it faster. And to follow that, I think, as a reader, you almost never see that in motorsport books, and so I thought it was very important to show that.
Right. We've already touched on the fact that from its earliest days, auto racing has been quite dangerous, and you tell us about certain incidents in racing history in which there were terrible catastrophes and terrible loss of life, including a race back in, I think, 1903, where more than a dozen drivers were killed, mechanics, spectators, in a single race due to a terrible kind of multi-vehicle crash. And interestingly, this seems to have had maybe an effect opposite from what we might expect, that rather than getting people to be less interested in something that was so dangerous, it actually seemed to fuel the interest of the public and the interest and competitiveness of the drivers themselves. Can you tell us more about that?
Sure. I mean, there's almost a, you almost get a sense, not only just in the reporting, you know, the magazine and newspaper reports, but if you, listen to interviews of individuals who, you know, watch these races, it almost had a kind of gladiatorial atmosphere to it. It was in some ways kind of a blood sport because there was so much death, there were so many accidents. I kind of relate it to sort of hockey, not in the book, but in my own mind, you know, hockey back in the 80s and 90s, where fights were sort of ubiquitous. You know, you would go to a hockey game and expect to see a good fight. And I think similarly in motorsport in the 30s, you would go, you know, and have that sort of sense of being on edge, sort of waiting and, you know, not wanting to see an accident, but that was kind of part of the thrill of it, this expectation, this danger that these people were pushing the envelope. And I think from the driver's point of view, you know, Rene Dreyfuss said that, you know, he was intimately acquainted with death, that at every race it was something that you expected, and that the drivers kind of had to accept that, and it was in some ways part and parcel of being a driver. So today, where you have accidents and cages and helmets and fire retardant suits and everything, you know, it's still a dangerous sport, but nothing compared to what it was like in the 1930s.
Hmm. At one point, you write these words: the drivers themselves felt they were part of a vanguard mastering the element of speed. The risk of death may have been the price, but it was worth it for the exhilaration of teetering at the edge of the impossible. This probably also helps us understand why someone like Adolf Hitler was so very, very interested in this. I mean, he was swept up in this just like so many other people were, but also saw beyond that what we would now look at as a rather nefarious purpose.
No, absolutely. I mean, the spectacle of these races, I mean, in Germany particularly, I mean, there were hundreds of thousands of people coming to attend these races. It was, in Germany and in Berlin, it was a huge propaganda event for them. And, you know, they played up the drama, they played up the sort of blood sport nature of it, and it played up, of course, the German domination of it. And just to sort of tether back to what you were talking about, you know, quoting earlier about what the drivers sort of teetering on the edge of the impossible, you know, I was very interested in sort of what drove these individuals to become Grand Prix race drivers. I mean, yes, there was celebrity, yes, there was money, but almost to an individual, you have them writing that, or saying in interviews that they've never felt more alive than when they were behind the wheel. They never felt like their life had as much clarity, that they were, you know, being in that moment in the present with nothing else there was everything to them on the road. And you can equate it some ways to what you read about mountaineers and their efforts in, you know, reaching peaks and climbing, that sense of everything else in the world disappears except for that sort of next handhold, that next reach. And very similar you see with these race car drivers.
Hmm. One of the things that I appreciate about your book, and I guess I'm especially impressed given the fact that you yourself do not have a long background in auto racing, but obviously have become something of an expert thanks to all of your researches, you seem to have a very good understanding of what it takes to be a successful driver. And I think for a lot of us who especially only watch this very casually on occasion, the whole matter of who's the faster driver, the better driver, what is behind that is kind of lost on us, isn't it? Just the person who just depresses the accelerator faster than everybody else and doesn't crash. and of course,
exactly.
there's a whole lot more to it than that. And I so appreciate the insightful descriptions that you give us of many of these drivers. In particular, one of the drivers who actually does not figure in this momentous race from 1938 that is kind of the centerpiece of your book, but a very major figure, a very important driver in this time, is someone by the name of, I believe, Louis Chiron, C-H-I-R-O-N.
Yes.
And
absolutely.
You describe him at one point with the nickname of the Old Fox. He was a daring but calm driver. And I just find that so intriguing that for as much as we might think of auto racers as being just kind of reckless and fearless and so on, here is one of the most successful drivers of the era being described as a daring but calm driver. Tell us a little more about him and about what is behind these deceptively simple words.
Sure. I mean, Louis Chiron was from Monte Carlo, and he was in many ways kind of René Dreyfus's mentor, that he was a few years older. He was one of the great drivers of the early 1930s, and he was daring and calm, as I quoted, but they also would comment about how he held the steering wheel almost like it was made of glass. And you had the sense that he was just taking everything sort of very gently and very carefully. But, you know, behind that sort of reservoir of calm was an absolute killer behind the wheel. And you see this again and again. I mean, the drivers were basically generally of two breeds. You have the Louis Chirons, who were calm, daring but reserved and sort of very intense, and then you have the likes of Tazio Nuvolari, the flying Mantuan, the great Italian driver who, you know, would flail about the cockpit, would beat the sides of the car, was anything but calm and was just hot-blooded all the way through, and was also an amazingly brilliant driver. And each of them had their own techniques and their own approaches. I mean, I was fascinated by René Dreyfus, who was also a sort of calm and very precise driver, but one of his great abilities was to know how hard and how far he could push a car, because he knew the mechanics of it intimately well, and so that too was a part of being a great race car driver. It's that sort of link between you and machine and knowing kind of like a jockey and its horse, how far you can push it to the breaking point. And so all of these elements are part of what it is to be a race car driver. And, you know, it's just, I mean, they were, you know, as I quoted at one point, you know, sort of matadors of their age. And to understand them was, to me, super important for the book.
Right. And by the way, there's a very interesting passage in the chapter called The Shadow, in which you really describe the significance of the so-called pit stop and of how the kind of work that a crew has to do. I mean, and that's true to this very day. It's by no means unique to the particular story you're telling in your book. But, I mean, that's also a very important ingredient in all of this, not just the driver and his car, but those that work on that car and those in that pit crew that have to facilitate refueling and other matters to keep that car in the best of shape for the race being waged at the time. And again, even if we have kind of a vague sense of that, most of us have no idea just what a finely honed machine that is, just the pit crew.
Yeah, I mean, the great German manager, Neubauer, said that was his secret weapon in motor racing, was the ability of his pit crew team. And it was really this period in the 1930s where that was professionalized. And the pit crews, you know, and again, this was a development by Mercedes and Auto Union, and just showing the intensity that they had to win, you know, of bringing, you know, kind of an army of pit crew workers to the events. They had been practicing, they had timed everything. And so pit crew stops in the 1934 to 38 period went from, you know, 2 minutes to change a tire and refuel and get everything going. That Neubauer and his Mercedes team had it down to a science of like 29 seconds. So you can imagine what a difference that makes if you're gaining a minute and a half over the course of a race that may have three pit stops.
Hmm. One important matter that is chronicled through the course of your book is the way in which the nature of auto racing in Europe begins to change. And at one point, and this is in a sense an observation by one of the main figures in your book, René Dreyfus, is what you call the widening chasm between countries. Races were increasingly a battleground between nations rather than individual drivers. So tell us first how that used to not be the case. How was it before? And then what began to change that made this, in a sense, a much more nationalistic undertaking?
You know, it's kind of cyclical between the motorsport being a sport about individuals, about the individual drivers, the individual teams, that being the sort of most important aspect. And then you have, of course, the nationalistic. Is it the French team winning? Is the German team winning? Initially, you know, in the late 1800s, again, it was individuals, and it was the particular cars and the manufacturers. And then right before World War One, you have everything's about France versus Germany versus the English versus the Italians. You have in the 20s and into the early 30s, again, everything being about the individual drivers. They would switch teams. They would move between countries. It was all about them as drivers. But with the rise of Hitler making, you know, in the statement of the 1933 Berlin Auto Show that Germany will dominate motorsport, very quickly after that, after all the investment that he put into Mercedes and Auto Union, it became a nationalistic endeavor. One, to show Germany was the best, that the Third Reich was the best government and had the fastest cars and reigned supreme. And the other countries, the other manufacturers, both in France and Italy and England and elsewhere, had to catch up with that. And so there became this kind of race in France to build a Grand Prix car to challenge the Germans. And that's exactly what happened with the Delahaye race car and René and Lucy.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Neil Bascom and talking with him about his amazing new book called Faster, How a Jewish Driver, an American Heiress, and a Legendary Car Beat Hitler's Best. So I think we've set the stage pretty well, although one thing I would really appreciate you doing briefly before we talk then about René Dreyfus and Lucy Chef is help us understand kind of the vast variety of races that existed at this point in time, and that how some races were around a track and some races were very much across country and over wide expanses of land. I mean, it is a much more complicated landscape than I think most of us would ever imagine.
Yeah, and dissecting it and trying to understand it, you know, in a pithy quick response is a little hard because there was such a range and such a different demand on the cars and the drivers given what the particular race was. So there were hill climbs where you would have a 10-mile climb starting at the base of a mountain to the top. Who would get there the fastest? It was one car would go at a time. You have rallies where they would go for, you know, sometimes weeks on end from various city to various city, driving thousands of miles to who got to the end destination first at a particular time following particular rules. You have sports car races where you have cars that need to be fitted out with you know, everything that you would normally need, lights and various other things, those kind of races like Le Mans and others. And then you have ones that go from town to town, 24-hour races, and then Grand Prix races around the city, races like Monaco or Po, where this track was short. It was 1.97 miles. So just an absolute range of races, and many of the great drivers like Rene and Rudy Caraccioli, who was kind of the German driver I feature most in Faster, you know, they were great at most of these. So they weren't just sports car drivers. They were hill climbers, and they were Grand Prix drivers. And, you know, for Rene's point of view, he was a rally driver as well.
Hmm. It's interesting to track the career of Rene Dreyfus and the fact that his fortunes begin to pretty much plummet. At one point, in fact, I think the year is 1936, you call him a jockey without a horse, a career that had pretty much come to a standstill. Explain why his fortunes soured as dramatically as they did.
I mean, that is a very simple answer. It was because he was Jewish. I mean, the name Dreyfus is probably, you know, in France at the time, the most known Jewish surname out there, although Rene wasn't directly related to the army officer who was indicted. His name definitely carried that weight. And so Rene found himself, although one of the great drivers of the early 30s, driving for Bugatti and Alfa Romeo and Maserati and wanted by all these teams, that the nationalism and worse, the fascism of Germany and Italy had largely seen him banned from the best teams with the best cars. So by 1936, he really is a jockey without a horse. He has no team that will take him. And that sort of sets up the situation where Lucy Schell is developing her own Grand Prix race team and is searching for a great driver, lands on Rene. And it's very clear, you know, the German team manager Neubauer said that, you know, if he could have recruited Rene, he would have, but Hitler never would have stood for it. And so he was a driver without a car.
We need to learn more about Lucy and the deep mark that she left on the auto racing world. And at a time when it was not very common, it was a male-dominated world in so many different respects, although there were a few women and some who achieved some success. She, of course, is a race driver herself for a while, but at some point makes the decision to devote her time and energy and especially her resources in a little different way. Explain this part of her story.
So Lucy, you know, to encapsulate Lucy, I mean, she was a very good rally driver. She was very tough. She was very focused on winning. She found herself by the mid-1930s, being surpassed by other younger drivers and needing a kind of new mission. And she was also very rich. She inherited a lot of money from her parents. And she also, I think the third part of it is she did not have a great love for Germany. She was a nurse in World War I, in France, and she saw all the sort of devastation caused by that war. And so with the sort of rise of militarism by the Germans, she wanted to sort of push back against that. So all that sort of comes together for her to say, listen, no one in France is doing anything to challenge the Germans. She's an American living there, and she says, well, if no one else is going to do it, then I'll finance my own team. I'll finance my own car to take on the Germans. It'll be my sort of new mission, and I'll be the first woman to own and run a Grand Prix team, and I'll be the one to lead them to victory over the Germans. And what's more remarkable than that ambition is that she manages to do it.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about this particular car company that is involved in this effort and the kind of monumental challenge that they were facing.
I mean, Delahaye was, you know, on the brink of bankruptcy, and a very bold decision by the chairwoman of the board in 1933-34 says, okay, well, we can't mass produce cars because that's too big of an investment. We can't dominate the sort of luxury market. So let's build, you know, some sports cars that work very well and promote our brand that way. And let's take a risk at it. And so they were known mostly for A, staid vehicles, and B, for building very durable trucks and mail trucks. literally the post office trucks and fire trucks. And so they ended up evolving one of those engines into a sports car engine, which was extremely successful. And then Lucy drove some of those sports cars for Delahaye in the Monte Carlo Rally. And then in 1936 goes to Delahaye and says, okay, well, you've done very good with the sports car and this six-cylinder engine. Now I want a 12-cylinder engine that spits out, you know, double the amount of horsepower, and I want a car that can go, you know, 150 miles an hour around a racetrack for hours on end. And like you said, it was a huge endeavor.
Mm. One thing that matters a lot are some of the choices that were made in designing this car. But another factor in this crucial race in 1938 was what René Dreyfus knew about the Mercedes cars that were going to be part of this race, and that for as formidable as these machines were, they had certain weaknesses that René Dreyfus knew about. Just say a quick word about that.
Well, the biggest weakness was they were too powerful. And so I think I write somewhere along the lines that, you know, they brought a cannon to a knife fight. And so in a close quarter around the houses circuit in Po, where it's very windy, you can't accelerate to the maximum speed of your car. You really need to focus on agility and speed at lower tolerances, essentially. So that is the weakness that René found when he was in the practice trials at Po, is that the Germans couldn't use their overwhelming power, and that if he drove consistently and well and aggressively where needed, he could beat them. And so it was very much a David and Goliath kind of moment.
Right. And of course, what is especially impressive about the victory that René Dreyfus is able to secure in this important race is that going into it, he knew what was at stake. He, in your words, if he won, his victory would be a symbolic triumph against the Nazi thugs. And I think that is really important to acknowledge. Sometimes there are critical moments in our history and we don't even realize it until we look back with hindsight and realize what something means. He knew, everybody knew what was at stake in this race, and yet somehow he managed to surmount the situation so impressively.
Yeah, and in some ways it was the inspiration, knowing that, you know, here he was, a Jewish driver taking on the Germans, you know, at the sort of, you know, feverish height of the anti-Semitism in Europe, was something that was very important. It was very important to win. And actually, one of his mentors in the mid-30s, you know, said, Rene, you know, you could be the greatest driver in the world if A, you were more aggressive, and B, if you were driving for more than just yourself. And I think what's cool about the story of Rene over the course of Faster is he comes to that realization, and Lucy kind of brings him there to be a more aggressive driver, to take more risks, and then B, to have something that you're fighting for, not just so you can be the number one driver and that you can have you can stand on the podium, but that you're fighting for more than that. You're fighting for a reason beyond yourself, and that again is what Lucy sort of brought to his focus, and that arc, and I think is super important to this story.
I want to mention that not only this crucial race that is kind of the centerpiece of your book, but many other important races are described in almost breathtaking detail. I mean, nearly lap by lap. How is it possible to know that amount of detail about races that were, you know, maybe run 90 years ago?
Well, the primary reason is journalism, motorsport journalism in the 30s was absolutely marvelous. I mean, it just was superb. And so you had, you know, scores of writers from newspapers and magazines attending these races and writing beautifully about them, and not just saying, you know, they ran this lap in 2 minutes and 32 seconds and this was who in the lead, but, you know, what the weather was like, what it smelled like, what the look on the racers' faces was, interviews with them afterwards. I mean, the amount of coverage, I mean, just volume, because motorsport was such a huge sport at that point in time. That you had the best journalists, the best writers attending these events. And so I was very lucky to have all those contemporaneous accounts from not only the French, but the Germans and the Italians and the British and the Americans, all collectively together. You know, a single race at Po had two huge volumes of just newspaper articles from all these, I mean, almost 1,000 newspaper articles over the course of, you know, a couple weeks around the event. And so I had more than enough material to probably write a whole book about each one of these races. But I promise I did not do that.
Well, it is a book that is just packed with fascinating information. And beyond that, the principal figures, including some of these talented and competitive drivers, emerges as vibrant and complicated human beings. So it's a lot more than just race results and numbers and car parts and so on. I mean, this is a powerful human drama, which you describe in an absolutely extraordinary fashion. It's an incredible book. And it includes, by the way, I want to mention a postscript in which, among other things, you explain at least what we believe to be the final fate of these impressive cars, French cars that were part of this impressive victory. The book again is Faster: How a Jewish Driver, an American Heiress, and a Legendary Car Beat Hitler's Best, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. It includes many intriguing photographs. The author, Neil Bascom. Neil Bascom, you've done it again. Thank you for bringing to the world yet another fascinating book, and thanks for talking about it today on The Morning Show.
It was a wonderful interview. Thank you very much.
I want to mention that this weekend going to be replaying on the Morning Show podcast my first interview with Neil Bascom, which was way back in 2004. His book, The Perfect Mile, Three Athletes, One Goal, and 4 Minutes to Achieve It, a book about the race for the first 4-minute mile. An achievement, of course, that belongs to English runner Roger Bannister. It's one of my all-time favorite interviews. And so that's going to be this coming Saturday's Morning Show podcast. The Morning Show podcast edition is available through Spotify, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast. Make sure that you look for the title, The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, in a more serious interview related to what we are experiencing right now, John Barry and his defense.